closer.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Pre-Accident Podcast. I'm your host, Todd Conklin. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks for subscribing. Thanks for being a part of it. I really appreciate that you're taking the time to listen to this and download them. So let's talk a little bit before we get started about something that I think is really important. The path to high reliability begins with the journey to human performance, an understanding of how humans perform in systems. And you hear us talk all the time. In fact, I'm terrible at it. I use the words high reliability and safety and human performance and hop and all these kind of words really interchangeably. And they're really not interchangeable per se. At least in my mind, the way I've kind of got it worked out is for an organization to move towards the new view, one of the most important first steps is to really build in a strong understanding of how humans perform. Human performance, HPI, or HU if you're from the new community, or HOP if you travel much internationally. This first section of how humans perform is really fundamental to moving an organization towards high reliability. And understanding that high reliability is really an attribute. It's an outcome of an organization that does very, very significant work, and the cost of failure is simply untenable. You can't fail. To get there, I think you have to do the pre-work. And the pre-work is in this fundamentals of how humans perform, human performance. And that's what we're going to talk about today. Now, today's guest is my buddy Bill Rego, and you're going to like him a lot. If you don't know Bill, this is a really pretty good opportunity to get to meet him. And Bill is a human performance practitioner. He's an engineer. He'll talk about that a bunch because engineers talk about being engineers a bunch. That's fine. That's good. That's what they do. He'll also talk a lot about how he thinks of and has managed human performance in his organizations and the organizations that he's currently working with. And I think you're going to find it to be really refreshing. It's been quite a week for me. Travel like crazy, but I guess that's the time to do so. Lots of really good stories. I think I'm going to make a podcast pretty soon here. Maybe I'll do this coming up. In fact, maybe the next podcast I'll do, I'll just tell some stories of success because I have a lot of great stories that I've been hearing, and I want to share them with you. It's fun. As organizations become much more attuned to the new view, they get a lot better. And not just better in their safety performance, which is kind of an outcome-y way to look at safety. They just get better at sort of managing work. The really interesting and kind of good news is they don't just get safer. They get more productive, and it impacts the quality. And so it's a really nice kind of three-way advantage to this notion of process improvement and continual learning and getting better. And so I'll do that for you. It's a promise. If you can hang on and gut your way through this, I'll do one where I just talk about some success stories. And I'll make that happen really soon. Next podcast. It's a deal. Until then, though, I want you to listen to Bill because he's got lots to share with us. And I think the takeaways from Bill are really pretty important. I mean, Bill talks a lot about the importance of engaging leadership early, the importance of understanding and building a lexicon, a language around high reliability, and the importance of human performance. And I think you'll just find Bill refreshing. He's definitely a smart cat, no question about it. So without much further ado, sit back, take your shoes off, open your ear holes, and listen carefully to Bill Rego as he discusses human performance, high reliability, and the new view.
So when I talked to him today, I embarrassed him because he hadn't listened to the podcast.
And now you're going to be a star of it.
Well, yeah. And, you know, I said, look, you need to listen to this guy. He's really interested, really interesting. And he's got a very good perspective on the new view of safety. And you need to listen to him.
So what do you think it is about this new view that is hard for senior leadership to accept initially. I submit that they accept it once they get it, but there's a lot of resistance at first. How come?
Oh, that's easy. And it's that for senior leaders, if they, in the old view, you tend to take a fairly linear view on causation. And what I see is the root cause of many of these accident investigations is the guy who touched it last made a mistake. And with that retrospective understanding, you know, we sit in these rooms and we weren't there and we don't know, but we're looking at the timelines and we're looking at what happened. And we go retrospectively, you know, with full 2020 hindsight, and we'd say, well, we're smarter than that guy and we're better than that guy. And we never would have made those decisions. And so the new view forces you to say, really, yeah, I would have done that. And I am either as smart or as dumb as that guy, and I am as distracted as that guy, and I would have done the same thing. So I think it's threatening for senior leaders to admit that they make mistakes too, and that there's stuff that they just don't know.
Tell me about your background.
Are we into the interview now?
Oh yeah, we're totally in it. We've been in it a while. We're knee deep, baby.
So I was 20 years in the Navy, Navy nuke, finished off as chief engineer of the USS Nimitz, went to work for the Savannah River site for DOE with Westinghouse, which turned into, CBS, turned into Morrison Knudsen, turned into URS that then got replaced by Fluor, and worked for them for almost 20 years. And now I've been consulting for about 3 years, part-time with Fluor and part-time for me and part-time for you.
Nice. Nice. Yes, we did an investigation, didn't we?
We did.
I think they call it a peer assist, but it was pretty much of an investigation. But do you remember the first time you were introduced to this human performance stuff? Because I bet your story is interesting.
So at the Savannah River site, we had several of our executives went through the INPO plant managers class, and they heard about this human performance stuff. And they were trained by a guy by the name of Tony Machera, who we both know.
That's right. Who would have been on the podcast right before you. Oh. So everybody listened dutifully last week to Tony's podcast, which by the way is amazing. It's really, really good.
Oh, I'm sure it was. And, so one of them came back and he said, we've got to have ourselves a human performance person and the SME for the company. And so I ended up interviewing for the position and got it. And then so I became the guy, and they weren't sure what to do with me. And so then I became the company rep to go to the FCOG Human Performance Committee, which you were on. And then shortly after that, I became the chair. So I chaired it for several years, and so that was my introduction to it. So I came on board like most everybody else does. We read all the INPO stuff, and which Tony Machera wrote most of it, and although he would deny it, and started, you know, and my focus was on error reduction, actually error prevention. And, you know, and you and I have had this conversation before, you know, and we got fooled that, you know, if you just reduce these errors to de minimis, we can be safe. And while that's not true, the point is that error reduction, as we now understand it, is just a part of the puzzle, and how organizations behave and perform is a much bigger part of that. So you and I kind of embarked on this journey, starting with error reduction, and then got into this whole notion of organizational performance, and then got into safety culture, and then got into a whole bunch of other stuff. that spanned, I guess you and I have been working together for probably 15 years now.
Yeah, I bet you're right on that. How much of this did you get in the Navy, or how much of it could you draw a line back to similar methods you used during your 20 years in the Navy?
So it all connected. And so when I went through this stuff, you know, and read the INPO Human Performance Manual and started reading, Reason and Decker and Shine and all those guys, I realized that what I was doing in the nuclear Navy was human performance, but we didn't call it that. We just called it disciplined operations. And the nuclear Navy is very different from the rest of the Navy, and it's very different from the military. So we tend to recruit really good people, but and we train them really well. But we were really the first of the highly reliable organizations, that Wyke and Sutcliffe and Carlene Roberts and those folks studied. And while they looked at the flight decks, the same high reliability organizations existed down in the engine rooms. So when I looked at human performance from the INPO perspective and looked at it from my company's perspective, it directly related to, you know, what we were living day to day in the Navy and the nuclear program.
That's remarkable. How would you define a highly reliable organization?
Well, it's an organization that does – It exists in a hazardous environment and does technical stuff, and it ought to have far more failures than it does.
Well, that's a really good way to describe that, actually. I like that a lot.
Yeah.
It ought to be worse than it is.
It ought to be. And so you look at that and you go, well, how come? And what I tell people is that, you know, if you had come to me back then when I was chief engineer on the USS Nimitz and said, hey, Bill, congratulations, you're the leader of a highly reliable organization, I would have told them that they were nuts. You know, and I've read Wyke and looked at what he calls a highly reliable organization, and we arguably were one. But I never would have acknowledged that at the time. And the reason was because we were focused on the little failures that we knew, you know, if we didn't take care of them, would kill us. And so we didn't believe that we were as good as we were. We were really humble about it. And we just weren't sure that what we thought was going on was what was really going on. And so we were constantly focusing on the work as it was being done.
Now, I think that's really important. You just said something really important. Highly reliable organizations never would know they're highly reliable because they always believe they're fixated on the fact that they're always failing, or right, always in the process of failing, I guess.
Right. And we're fixated on the next failure, really.
And that's what scares me about the attributes of a highly reliable organization, and this happens all the time, is they read Wyke's 5 attributes and they say, and now we are that. I'm fixated with weak signals, right? You know,
right.
But a good, reliable organization never believes they're a good, reliable organization. They're constantly fixated on the fact that they may not be as reliable as they think they are.
Right, and that was my experience. I was totally focused on, you know, how can we do better? Because what we're doing today isn't good enough.
That's remarkable. Now you, so I consider you a master trainer. You know, probably one of the very well. No, I do. I'm not sure I'm the standard of that, but I mean, you're one of the best, really, HRO, human performance, New View trainers in the world. You're certainly, I mean, you're top 3, if not number 1 in the United States. How come? Why?
Well, like, I don't believe that, number one.
Well, I'm not sure there's a real list. I'm making all this crap up. You know that, right?
I think you are. But I think it's because, you know, I don't think I'm as good as I am. I'm constantly reading. I'm constantly looking at other ways of telling stories. And in fact, I tell stories more than I teach. And I think that's important. And I also think, you know, because my audience tends to be technical people, and the fact that I'm an engineer tends to lend credence to what I have to say. So I think, you know, the person who gets up in front of an audience, number one, has to be, I think, technically trained or educated.
Oh, I would push you on that, and I guess I might as well. That's why we're talking. Yeah. I actually think it's more than technically. I mean, I agree with you completely. They need to have a technical expertise by that big T technical. I also think to be successful, to be at the caliber you're at, you have to have a depth of knowledge in your technical field and a depth of knowledge in sort of the new view. And it's that mutual depth of knowledge that I think makes you a powerful force.
Well, what's interesting, and we've talked about this in the past, while I'm an engineer and I look at people who are really good at this stuff, Tony Machera, Ralph Soule, Bill Corcoran is another one.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
When I look at these people, they're not your typical engineers, okay? They tend to be extroverted, although that's not uniform, but they're always intuitive, and they're, you know, they've got a fairly strong thinking perspective, although yours is more feeling. And I think it's that intuition that is very different. So in the commercial nuclear program, and really kind of in the Navy as well, on the Myers-Briggs scale, you tend to have a lot of ISTJs, the introverted sensing, thinking, judging type people. In our field, people tend to have a high factor of intuition. And so by that, and I used to think I just thought differently, and I do, but the intuitives, well, the ISTJs see what they see, and that's all that they see, and they base their decisions on what they see. The intuitives see what they see, and then they look for the gaps. They look for what's missing, and it's in the gaps that the true learning takes place. And I think that's the perspective that you and I and Machera and you know, all the other folks that we know bring, because we tend to all be wired that way. And so to combine a technical background and a more intuitive approach to problem solving is fairly unique. And I think that does bring a unique perspective in front of a class of fairly skeptical people. So does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. I mean, I agree with you. Let me ask you this question. So think of this. I don't know how to ask the question. Think of it in like PowerPoint slides, which is a crappy way to ask this question, but it's all I got. What slides have always been in your fundamentals class? And what slides are you constantly tweaking and changing?
Oh, man.
And you'll probably have to describe the slides. That's why it's a crappy question.
So, I'm going through a curriculum review right now, and so I'm filled with data. The slides that I always use is I look at the anatomy of the event, because that's a fairly good way to describe how events happen. I always look at this notion of drift and accumulation, and work is imagined and work is done, which is a very powerful slide. And I always include a slide on knowledge, skill, and rule-based errors. And those slides always work for me. I spend a lot of time on error, you know, errors in terms of knowledge-based, rule-based, and skill-based, because a lot of people misunderstand that. But I tweak the message that goes with them based on who the audience is. And so, you know, if I'm talking to nuclear power folks, I'll emphasize it one way. If I'm talking to crane mechanics or riggers, I'll skew it another way. If I'm talking to nuclear operators at a DOE facility, you know, I'll emphasize some other parts of it. And so that's how I tweak it. I always start a class with the counting game, which I learned from you and which several of us have done throughout our classes. And that sets us up to really understand, you know, this notion of how cultures begin, how work is really done, the importance of management, setting up systems, and then gets us going to set us up through the class. And it also is a nice physical exercise for folks who are coming in expecting one thing and they get something else.
Yeah, it definitely sends a signal that this is going to be a little different. So that works well.
And it always is.
Yeah, it is. It's always different. That's for sure. What's new? What's the newest slide you just added? Or what are you adding since you're in the middle of a curricula review?
I'm trying to integrate Kahneman's System 1 and System 2 thinking into some of my slides. And so I read Kahneman's book, on that subject, which is kind of his grand opus at the end of his life. And it was a difficult read for me, but you know, the thinking fast and thinking slow makes perfect sense. And the way that I illustrate that, and we've talked about this again, is I'll get two people from the audience and I'll start walking in a circle on the stage. And I'll have the first person recite the alphabet from A to Z. And then And they do it really, really well. And they'll have the second person recite the alphabet from Z to A.
So is this also a drunk check?
Well, usually it's before lunch.
Okay, so no. No, okay, good.
So no. And what invariably happens is the person that's doing it from Z to A stops walking. Because they have to think about it. And it's a perfect example, I think, of showing the audience, here's what systems one thinking looks like, and here's what system two thinking looks like. And so when we start getting into why do bad things happen because people weren't thinking, it's because we didn't allow them to slow down to think in the first place when they're faced with an anomaly. And of course, in the HRO thoughts, with Wyke and Sutcliffe, we're supposed to be sensitive to faint signals. And it's those faint signals that really should put you into system two thinking. And so I use that as an introduction into the, you know, if I'm talking about HRO, to look at within HRO, when do you need to be in system one thinking and when do you need to be in system two thinking? So that's kind of where I'm going right now, and I'm not all the way there yet, but it's a work in progress.
But I think it's important because I think managers believe, certainly proximally and retrospectively after an event happens, that the worker should have thought their way out of this problem. And I really think that's a dangerous and pretty naive way to respond to an event, but I hear it all the time.
Yeah. And you know, I think we give, you know, sharp end workers too much credit for free will, you know, for actually making informed choices. And, you know, and I make the same mistake myself. And, you know, I come into accident investigations and I see what happened and I go, well, I know exactly what happened. And of course I'm wrong. But this notion that people have free will all the time is wrong. And so when they make these types of mistakes, they're doing what they've always done. They miss the anomaly, and went right on through it. It's kind of like when you're talking on a cell phone while you're driving and you miss a red light and you end up going through a red light and have a wreck. And so we think, well, that was a choice, and it really wasn't.
And that's really pretty powerful. Good stories. Anything fun? What's the best thing that's ever happened to you working with this NewView stuff?
I think it's when a couple of things. One is when we're doing accident investigations, and we get this glimmer of understanding from the person who touched it last, who readily admits that they screwed up and it was all their fault and they were the root cause. And then they begin to understand that while they were wrong and they won't do it again, they were set up for failure. And so it's that, you know, when I see that in the middle of an investigation, that light bulb going on, that's really powerful. And the other thing is when I'm teaching and I have people argue with me, which I love.
Me too.
And so it's the people that argue with you that go back and they go read this stuff and they come back to you and they become your biggest converts.
Yeah, and I agree. So
when I get people that argue with me, I make a very quick determination as to whether or not they're thoughtful or not. And if they're thoughtful, you know, I engage them and then I give them a reading list and I tell them to go read this stuff and then come back and let's talk one-on-one. And they're the ones who become the best practitioners. And I love those folks.
So what's next? What's the future?
Well, I'm going to continue. I'm doing part-time work with the Fluor Corporation. I'm trying to get them to be as successful as General Electric. But in the meantime, I'm working with other companies. I've been working with you, which I loved, and traveling all over the country, teaching and speaking at conferences and things like that. And I'm going to continue doing that until it's no longer fun. But I love it.
Is the word book in your future anywhere?
You know, I don't know. While I'm a fairly disciplined person, I'm not sure I have your discipline, but if I was going to write a book, it would be about this very specialized concept of engineering human performance. And you and I and Tony have talked about this at some length. And what I find is, and what INPO has found, is that engineers really don't get it. And by that, I don't mean that they're not smart, because they are, but they don't understand that people are not machines. And so engineers tend to think very linearly, and they tend to make mistakes that aren't seen for 5, 10, 15, sometimes 35 years. And there's no real feedback mechanism for their mistakes. And so if I write a book, it's going to be about that, this whole concept of how engineers make mistakes within the system in a human performance perspective. But I don't think that's a book that's been written, but it kind of excites me. And if I ever, you know, and that's something that I do want to write about. And when I was running the mentoring program at the Savannah River site, you know, we would do personality profiles on every engineer and every mentor. And what we discovered was 80% of our engineers were introverted and analytical. And when you think about that, you go, well, duh.
So what advice would you give a leader who is trying really hard to get their organization to shift into the new view? So safety leader, manager, you know, plant manager, what would you tell them? Because you've got a lot of experience under your belt. What do they need to be thinking about? What's first? What's second? What's the most important?
I think you've got to start with top leadership. And that's easy to say. It's hard to do. But if you don't have top level leadership's understanding, you're just not going to go anywhere. So I've done it a number of different ways.
Let me interrupt you.
Yep.
Can you train your own leaders, your own top leaders?
I don't think so.
Yeah, I don't either. I think it's the old, you can't be a prophet in your own country, but
right.
I almost think you have to have somebody from outside come and do the top leadership, but that's just me. I'd be curious if you agree.
But you have to start somewhere, and I start there. The second thing I would start with is your investigations. How do you do investigations? And I think you do that similar to this one company that we looked at that had done a study, and they found out that in almost all of their investigations, they stopped at the person who touched it last. And so that worker who touched it last was the root cause. And I see that wherever I go, and you do too.
Well, one of the things I think is interesting, and this is a question you and I sort of discovered, but I've started asking it a bunch, is ask leaders why they do investigations. And I'm shocked, actually shocked, that they have a difficult time answering that question.
Yeah, I think you're right. When I look at that, and again, that's part of the senior leadership class, is I'll come in and I'll read their investigation reports. And I read them backwards. And I start with the corrective actions. Then I go to the causes. And then I go to the evidence in the report. And what I find is that the corrective actions are voluminous and numerous. And it usually revolves around, you know, what Reason calls name, blame, shame, train, and write a new procedure. And then you look at the causes, and if you read the causes correctly, you'll find that the corrective actions don't actually fix the causal factors that they've identified. But that's okay, because the evidence in the report doesn't support the causal factors that they arrived at, nor would the corrective actions fix what the evidence in the report suggests. And so when I see that, I go to the responsible managers and I'll ask them if they wrote the corrective actions before the investigation started. And they usually say yes, if they're honest. And that's normally what happens, is they'll go, yeah, we got to fire the guy that touched it last, and we've got to write some more procedures, and we've got to have some training that tells people to be more careful. And I'll ask him, why do you do that? It's kind of like your question, why do you do investigations? Why do you write corrective actions that way? And they usually tell me that that's because they think that's what the regulator wants. And I go, well, but how are you going to learn from that? And they really don't have a very good answer. So I use their own examples in the training to get the rest of the management team to understand why accident investigation or event investigation is so important. But so once that happens, then I think you've got to train your technical staff. And so by the time you train the workforce, and they don't need much, they need, you know, a couple hours of human performance training. What they get is the new view of safety that they've actually been living for a while, but they didn't understand. And when they step out of the classroom, they step into the new view with a different context. And so that's how I think I do it, is senior leadership, change the way you do investigations, train your technical staff, and then train your workforce, and then start doing learning teams, which we've been talking about for years, so that you can understand how work actually gets done and how to really do it better.
Sounds perfect. Did we cover it? Anything we missed?
Oh, we missed a bunch of stuff, but yeah, we don't have time.
That's right. Thanks for your time, man. You were amazing.
Thank you, Todd. As always.
Life-changing.
So there you have it, podcast listeners and listenettes. That's the fabulous and amazing Bill Rego. Bill's great. He is super fun to talk to. And quite honestly, I'm really proud we got it, you know, kind of jammed into 30 minutes. We're really at about 34 minutes. Sorry, I'm a little long. But Bill's got lots to say, and that's good. Bill has a lot of knowledge. He's technically incredibly competent. The engineering background he brings to a conversation makes a huge difference. But you know what Bill's got the most of? Experience. Hard knocks, scabs, and scrapes. He's actually done this. He's drug organizations through this journey many times and many different people. That experience, I think, really pays. In fact, I kind of think in many ways that's the key to understanding and diffusing these new view ideas. It's been a great podcast. Thank you for your time. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends. Subscribe. That seems to make some kind of difference. And as always, keep learning, have fun, and for goodness sakes, be safe.